hard to know exactly where to start because the subject is rather large, and we don't want to just go on week after week on it. We're finding every place in the Bible about it. But there are certain principles about the revolution in Scripture. Now, you take, for instance, in Revelation, the book of Revelation, there's one earthquake mentioned there in connection with the... the sixth seal, I think it was, talks about the... that there was an earthquake and the islands were... all the islands and mountains were moved. But the distinction there was that they were not removed. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to be moved, and that this revolution refers to the French, this earthquake refers to the French Revolution, which did have an effect. This is getting on the other recordings too.
I think that's Revelation 6:12.
We don't have a tape, all right. Andy, if you give it, Andy.
No, he has a tape.
Oh, I thought I had space on the tape. I don't have enough.
Oh, well, mine's up in the attic. And it's late now. We have to have a short study. now, in the Revelation, the sixth chapter, has to do with the earthquake that pertains to the French Revolution. But the thing is, this particular revolution is one that is not like an industrial revolution or of a change of just one government to another, but had to do with the breaking of a previous social order altogether in an abrupt fashion, in a violent, it is violence attached to it. Yes?
Is this Revelation 16, the French Revolution?
No, 6.
Oh, 6.
6. Revelation 6. As we understand this subject of a revolution in the Scripture, or earthquake, it refers to the breaking of the earth's crust. That crust representing the present social order of the day, whatever it happens to be. The great one at the end of the age has to do with the termination of the present order of human arrangements as we know it now. But through history, where it occurs, it refers to a violent overthrow of a previous existing order. The three stages, then, of an earthquake are shown in Elijah's, the prophet's, experience in Sinai, where he saw the wind break the mountains, rend the rocks, and then rend the rocks, then came an earthquake, and then came fire, and then the still small voice. But the point is that the fire, which is a result of an earthquake, is associated with the lava, which is the molten interior of the earth. And when the earth's crust breaks, a fissure occurs, this molten lava either bubbles out or explodes out in the form of rain in some cases. In other cases, it just flows, rolls down the hill. And that lava is molten lava, molten rock, and everything in its path that's combustible will burn as it goes down until it gradually cools off and then solidifies into a particular type of rock they call in connection with volcanic rock. All right, now, in the revolution at the end of the age, then, refers to the destruction of the present order, and that it will be in two major stages. One first has to be the breaking up of the present order in order that anarchy can prevail. Now, you take the Russian Revolution. There was a short period of anarchy back there, as it were, where they took the Tsar out and they shot him and the family, and then the communists took over, 1917, and establish the present union of the Soviet republics, the Russian government. But that government is a very strong government. It doesn't tolerate any insurrection under it. It's a very stable order. And if anybody doesn't do what he's told, he knows of it in a short time. But in the scriptures, when the earthquake of the scriptures occurs at the end of the age, there's no control. The people wander throughout the earth. These bands wander from place to place, and there's no authority, no central authority that can curb them. And therefore, this lawlessness is completely rampant to such an extent that all the ordinary affairs of life are stopped. There's no buying of goods or selling of goods. There's no planting or building of houses at that time, but everything is in disarray because one cannot partake of the fruit of his labors. It's complete lawlessness. Now, that lawlessness cannot even occur in the general sense until the government, the constraining authority, is overthrown. Because that stability, whether it be a mountain or a plain or an island, no matter what kind of a government it is, whether it's a dictatorship, fascist or social government, or whether it's a democracy, they're all stable orders, but of different kinds. The government has to be overthrown so that there is no organized national army or police force or fire department or so forth, because there are no wages can be paid, money doesn't mean anything. And so it's the overthrow of the present governments in earth precedes the anarchy of Revelation, of the Bible. The anarchy, the fire aspect, is the time of trouble in reality. All the other things that are incidental before that are incidental or preparatory in their nature. But this lava coming, and this is the stage that we're particularly interested in. Now, Revelation, the 16th chapter, it doesn't tell necessarily about the lava and all. It's just one big revolution. So we'll read that one.
Okay.
Now.
Yes.
Did you say that this was in two stages, the breaking up and then the lawlessness would be the second stage?
Yes, that's the stage in which it has to occur before general anarchy can occur.
Did you say that the governments would fall before anarchy?
Yes.
Or in anarchy?
Before anarchy. The governments. And the people, these armed bands of people are roaming all around. There's no government. There's a slogan down in lower part Manhattan, where law ends, anarchy begins. And it's in Latin, down near City Hall, New York, in a big building there, one of the justice buildings. And so when the enforcement agencies are no longer in existence to curb this authority, then you come to the time of trouble that the scripture's talking about. Not that there aren't other troubles, and very, very severe ones. But we can't say that the trouble today is worse than Sodom and Gomorrah, right? It says, such as there never was since there was a nation. Well, what about Sodom and Gomorrah? Weren't the conditions very evil even before it? Then the Lord rained down the fire and destroyed them. But that period, that in connection with their imminent destruction, it says a time of trouble such as there was. Most people think of it just as it spread out more to more people. But the troubles of past ages sometimes engulf the whole civilized world of that day, of those days back there. So to all practical effects, it was very... Take the French Revolution. Wasn't there the guillotine and a lot of violence and lawless there? And but it says that the time of trouble, such as there never was since there was a nation. So if you take the troubles today that exist in the earth, can we say that they're worse than the French Revolution? Than the siege of Jerusalem in A.D. 70? When the Jews were massacred back there? No, the time of trouble in the Bible is the anarchy that's pictured at the end of the age, where there's complete universal lawlessness in the earth, and where the hope of mankind is just about perished. Because who's going to stop this conflagration, this figurative conflagration? Nobody. It's beyond human repair. And therefore, they have to look up to God for a stop to that particular time of trouble, because then it's so out of hand that nothing else can curb it.
So, Franklin, would the government go down into the revolution?
Now it depends which one we're talking about. See, now we have
the three stages of Elijah's vision.
In Elijah's vision, he was given a preview of things to come. And there, it is in successive order. But those are not considered the parts of the time of trouble. For instance, the still small voice was one of the things there too. There was the wind breaking the mountains, there was the earthquake, and there was the fire, and the still small voice. Now, it merely shows that there are four stages of introduction to the kingdom, the first one being the breaking of the rocks. But that doesn't mean that's the time of trouble. It is trouble, but that is not the time of trouble. But it sets the stage. It prepares the way. Because we've had other wars, and very, very severe ones, even in ancient times. But at the end of the age, this is the successive order in which the kingdom will be established. It'll be preceded by a period in which there'll be conflagration or official wars, which will weaken the economies and impoverish the peoples. And then comes later on, you have the earthquake, which is the overthrow of all governments, which is like anarchy. You say anarchy is the overthrow, but the worst part about anarchy is the period subsequent to the overthrow of the government. Most in our own minds, we think of the violence associated with the destruction and causing governments to go down, and that's terrible. Where the people pull the governments down, you think that's terrible, because in the past things have happened which saved mankind from universal destruction in the past, because either it was localized in one area or one part of the world, and thus other nations took the warning and it didn't spread into the disaster that's to occur at the end of the age preparatory to the kingdom. However, it's the period after the fall of the government that's so terrible. Bad as it is, the hard experience before that, the other is what the church is to be spared, because that lawlessness that occurs afterwards is so disheartening to the spirit that it makes people begin to question the integrity and the power of God and so forth. Now we come to, let's take as an illustration, the Revelation, the 16th chapter, where you have the three parts. Let's say the 17th verse. You notice in reading there that it tells about the seventh angel pouring out his vial into the air, and then there was a great voice out of the temple in heaven from the throne saying that it is done. Now the 18th verse says there are voices, thunders, lightning, there was a great earthquake. All this is associated with this great earthquake. And these are not stages of development. For instance, the thunders and lightnings are merely descriptions of this earthquake, that in connection with it, associated with it, is a great hubbub of sound, voices, disturbed voices of the multitudes. All the people are involved. That's why their voices, they're involved. And then comes, there's these lightnings and thunderings. There was a great earthquake. It's saying this is what it is, all this that's associated. such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great, and the great city was divided into three parts. And the city of the nations fell, and great Babylon came into remembrance before God to give to her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. Now this great city, then, is Christendom. And is the three parts are composed of the beast, the dragon, and the false prophet, which earlier are seen to do a unifying work. The three unclean spirits, like frog, go out of the mouth of three symbols, the beast, the dragon, the false prophet, to gather all the nations together to Armageddon. They're unifying to stave off some purpose. But what happens? The thing is frustrated. What happens? There's a division. The three that came together now go apart. The great city, this great coalition at the end of the age, proves very short-lived. And thus it goes apart. This is the breaking, the earthquake is this explosion. And what happens in this violence that ensues there? Comes the downfall of the churches. The actual destruction, where they go in and they do just what they did in the Russian Revolution, where they went in and destroyed the churches or desecrated them and burnt up the statues of the saints and so forth, and smashed them, and did every sort of thing they could to downgrade the Christian religion. So you have the same thing here, that when this occurs, the great city is divided, that it'll be no more profitable for Catholicism and Protestantism to support the civil government because they're all in disgrace. And each one then separates for their own safety. They separate because it isn't practical for that, you know, it doesn't do what the thing that they really hoped would do.
So it's you say it would be the destruction of the churches. So if they divide, there won't be any left in the
church. That's right. But what happens, it says, that the beast and the false prophet were taken and cast alive into the lake of fire and brimstone. That when this separation comes apart, the three come apart, that the religious element falls first in reality. They divide, like in an earthquake, you have this great rupture of the present social order, a great change. Catastrophic change takes place, and then two of these three parts are dealt with right away, the beast and the false prophet, and they're cast alive. They're struggling for their own safety. They're not trying to support anybody else but their own order, and they're cast into the lake of fire. That is, they're completely destroyed as entities. We're not talking about the individuals of the system, but the system itself. In other words, there'll be no more churches then, no more church services. Church services will be canceled at that time, and because of the wrath of the people, and their frustrations and anger at that time will be so great, and their poverty and no wages and all, they're not in the mood to do business as usual or to worship as usual. It has to be done on a different basis, where they look upward. They shall walk through the land, hard bestead and unhungered, and they shall look upward to me in that day. It also says they shall curse their God and their king. So the people are now so angry that they are speaking against the national authority, the civil authority, as well as the religious. And we see this today, this disrespect. These are rumblings today. These are murmurings of dissent. But in that day, there'll be not just rumblings. It will be the thing of the day. It will cause... yes?
So Frank, do we have any scriptures to show that will happen in that sequence?
Well, we have. And was that the 17th chapter?
But it would be ecclesiastical first?
Yes. Because remember, it says in the 18th chapter that that great city... Alas, alas, and the kings of the earth stand afar off, watching the smoke of her burning. And now in that chapter, it shows papacy's downfall precedes that of the king. But in another chapter, it mentions another detail, that at the time papacy falls, Protestantism also falls at the same time. And that's pictured by the false prophet. The beast, papacy, and the false prophet are cast alive in the lake of fire and brimstone, where the other only deals with papacy.
What are the cities of the nations?
The city is a coalition. This is this great, at the end of this age, the adversary is back of this, because it says the spirits of demons are in these three systems at this time, where they're unitedly warning the people that they must join. And this is in harmony with the 13th chapter, where it says everybody has to have the mark of the beast. This gathering work of these three systems, where they're together, unitedly telling the people that they must obey, it harmonizes with these other details, where those who don't have this mark of cooperation with this movement will be branded as being not in sympathy with. And so they'll be branded as outcasts, where the others will be branded as adherents, supporting the system. And those having the mark of the beast, supporting the system or arrangement, even though they're only doing it for prudent purposes, they will not be interfered with at that time. But after that coalition comes together, and there will be many other indications to indicate that it's thoroughly impractical, because there are going to be differences amongst themselves, and there's going to be dissension within the ranks, and a lot of other problems arise where they will rupture apart violently.
Now, the great city was divided. That's the coalition.
Yes.
The cities of the nations fell, and great Babylon came in remembrance. Now, the city is more than just Babylon.
That's right.
All right. Now, the cities of the nations.
That's right. This is telling us that a city is a government normally. Well, this government is composed of three parts. It's also showing that it embraces the more or less the whole Christian world. The fact it puts it in the plural says it's not just the United States that this is going to happen here, but it'll happen in all the other countries, in Europe as well as in England and down in South America. So, yes?
I thought maybe it's just like repeating it. The great city was divided into three parts, and those cities of the nations fell. Is that possible?
The cities would be the religious element of the nations.
Well, no, the city is the new government of that day, which has both the religious and the civil. And when it says the cities of the nations fell, it indicates that this is a multinational movement. It's not a movement in one or two countries, but it's a movement in many, many countries where this united cooperation endeavor to bring about a peaceful order, to suppress all unrest, that it won't be just peculiar to this country or another, but it will be more or less embrace the globe from a relative standpoint. And that in that particular thing, when it's seen that it won't work, the thing will collapse not just in one country, it collapses all over at about the same time, and that they all fall. These cities and nations fall, but they are from one sense made up of many nations, and from another standpoint, they are one supranational order, S-U-P-R-A, different than one single. They are like one nation composed of many nations. So the city in the singular refers to the united, from a united standpoint, where it's mentioned in the plural, it's now meaning that when the fall takes place, it will affect it in all its various parts, right down the line. But then when this happens, this division occurs, the first part of that coalition that's affected is the religious. The religious is the one that receives the wrath of the people first. And that's the one that falls. The other, they separate. See, they separate into their component parts. Three parts. And of these three parts, Catholicism and Protestantism are dealt with first, and they are called Great Babylon. It tells in the 17th chapter that the mother is Babylon the Great. Well, you can say that the other way around. Great Babylon is the mother who is the mother of daughters, is the great whore who has daughters associated with her. So it refers to the religious part of that order will be in come into remembrance first, rather than just the church.
Then the cities would be the coalition and Babylon would be the papal.
The papal element. Aspect of it, which is really the one who did the undercover work to start with. The whole thing is the mother's scheme. She's in back of it all, and her name is attached to it, see. She promoted it, just like Herodias schemed for the king and the daughter to do the dance and get John the Baptist's head. But the mother is in back of it all. Now, it gives the name of this city as, in one sense, it's Babylon the Great. It has the mother's name. But actually, it's not. When it fragments, that one who gave it its name, the mother who is in back of it all, that's the one that the public will know is the responsible member, the most responsible member, and she's dealt with summarily. The very fact that they deal with her first shows that the people will recognize her role for what it really is. And therefore, they'll forget the state. In their wrath, they'll go first to the churches. Who in that particularly. And in this, as just like a pack of wolves, when they get the taste of blood, then they lose all sense, and then they'll go after the Protestants. Why, might as well get rid of the whole thing. Why stop there? Why stop with just the... And so, just like in the Russian Revolution, they didn't have any distinction between Protestant and Catholic. But it was the Greek Catholic Church that was particularly obnoxious to them. It's patterned very much like the Roman, except for along certain differences. But
then would you apply this conflict to Russia?
No, this is what we're trying to say, that just like you have your United Nations today, the United Nations has no religious element. It's just the nations. You have the World Council of Churches. It's a council or federation of churches. And the papacy isn't in there. But the papacy has ones in sympathy with her. There's the Greek, Armenian, Coptic, a lot of other Catholic churches that in their type of government, they're very similar. And thus they have an affinity one for another, just like the Protestants have in connection with their more liberal type of democratic in varied forms in connection with their church service. But what we have not seen is where the three get together yet. Where we see the organisms being formed, slowly formed. You have the beast, the dragon, the false prophet, but they're not unitedly speaking to the people. Because each are doing their thing in their own sphere of influence, but they're not doing it jointly together. This at the end of the age, the one hour of the beast is the one who is the motivating influence that gets the one hour of power in connection with the kings of the earth and Protestantism with her. And thus that is the great city or coalition that's formed. But it's the beast that was in back of it. Which is the organized, or the woman from another standpoint. And thus it gets the name, from God's standpoint, the name of that city. But when it fragments, it's really the mother thereafter first, then the other daughters, and then after that has accomplished, then they go and deal with the state, because it's just a natural thing. Things are now so out of hand. Now you have the Samson, when he pulled the temple down. You notice those pillars, you wonder, which are they, church and state? I would say they're the two branches of the church. And that when the church is pulled down, these two segments of the church are pulled down, the collapse of the present order is next in line, which the roof caved in. You mentioned how many thousand were on the roof and that they collapsed, and Samson died as well. But the pulling of the pillars affected the whole social structure, literal building back there. And so the fall of the church at that time will have a particular significance because of its prior setup, where the people's next, they are now going to go turn against their own governments next. Where now, if they did it, they wouldn't necessarily turn against the civil. They'd be satisfied just with the church. But in view of the just immediately prior federation of the two religious and the one civil, when the two religious are dealt with, they still have in mind that coalition. And so they're not satisfied until they pull the state down. Had that not happened, that coalition, it might stop. Just with the, there might be some degree of pacification with just the destruction of the religious order.
Did this occur during or after Jacob's trouble?
Now, that's this is now what the part of the study is on. Now, all these things have to happen. The daughter, the mother and the daughters have to be taken care of first before the state falls. Now, this would indicate several things. The church has to receive its change before the church falls, before Babylon falls. So we see the first thing happens that the little flock go beyond the veil. Now, when the little flock go beyond the veil, during the hour of power of the beast, somewhere in that hour, they are, because they have the power then, just like Satan had an hour of power and put Jesus to death, Satan, that now has come the prince of this world and hath nothing in me, and he, at that his hour, apparently of triumph, he put to death Jesus. So at this end of the age, there's going to be an hour of power of Satan. Satan again is going to have that opportunity where he seems to have everything his way. And what's he going to do first? He puts to death a little flock during the beast hour of power. Then what happens? You have the great company class left. And they come out when Babylon falls. Out comes this company. Now the point is this. How long a period of time is there between the fall of Babylon and the kingdom, the establishment of the kingdom in power and glory? Well, I'm now inclined to think it'll be 3 years instead of the 1 year Pastor Russell mentions for several reasons. One is that when we had this study of Elijah, that's mentioned there, that they searched 3 days for the body of Elijah before the sons of the prophets were convinced that Elijah had been taken. And if the 1260 days of Elijah represent 1260 years, the 3 days of Elijah represent also 3 years. 1260 days, 1260 years, 3 days, 3 years. And that this then would be the period of time that it would take to convince the sons of the prophets that Elijah previously had been taken. All right, now you have a 3 year period. We're trying to make it a little more practical. Now, in that period of time, we know that certain things cannot happen. The ancient worthies can't be resurrected while the ancient, while the little great company are here. Because of what reason? So let's just consider a few very quick.
The blood is tied.
All right, the blood is mortgaged. The ransom merit of Christ is mortgaged and loaned on behalf of the imputation to the church members, the consecrated. And until they all die in death, that has to be there as their protection from wrath, from justice, so that God can deal with them in a favorable way. Now, also another is, it's called the Church of the Firstborn. The title Church of the Firstborn, having to do with the Passover, includes the little flock and the great company. They're all included as the Church of the Firstborn. We haven't time to go into this as a picture because that takes a little time, but that's amply when you reason upon it, that's true. Now, if they're the Church of the Firstborn, the great company class, and they're not members of the first resurrection, it shows that there's a distinct separation between the little flock's resurrection, where they're called the first fruits, and they're also called partakers of the first resurrection, where the great company are not. Therefore, the firstborn is a more liberal term covering a much larger period of time, including both the little flock and the great company class. Therefore, there is a break between the two, distinctly separating that the little flock go beyond, and there is a period of time before the great company receive their change, as far as a class, and before their resurrection. Their death is one thing. That can be helter-skelter and strung out. But the resurrection aspect, that's another thing. So they have to be resurrected first. All right, now we have the little flock change, comes the great company change quite a bit later, because what about that 3 years? Elisha searched with the sons of the prophet for those 3 years. And then the sons of the prophets were satisfied that it was indeed true that Elijah had been taken, the Elijah class. Now, that would mean then that there, if that's true, if this is 3 years a period of time, we would mean then that it would be about 3 years before and would be very near the end of the age, extremely near the end of the age. Now, the next point is this. Little flock, great company. Now, what's the next thing that can't happen until the great company goes?
Satan can't be bound.
All right, Satan can't be bound. That's right. Satan's binding comes next. Because he is the one that's going to deal with the great company class. To deliver such a one to the adversary, while that happens to individuals down through the age, the tabernacle teaches that after he had made an end of the atonement, that had to do with the sin offering class, after they die, after the bullock is slain and its blood taken in, after the goat is slain and its blood taken in, then he takes the scapegoat into the wilderness to die. That's then telling us that the real anarchy does not begin until the adversary first deals with this class, the great company. Because, so then you have the little flock, the great company, then the binding of Satan. Another thing, Satan has to be strong at this period of time, because it says, put on the whole armor of God so that you can withstand the wiles of the adversary. And having stand, this is telling about the very last members of the Christ class. They have the whole armor of God, and they're standing for this onslaught of the adversary. It says our power. So instead of the adversary getting weaker and being bound more and more, it's the opposite true. He's allowed a little more liberty at the end, at the very end, before he is bound. And indeed, the great company class have to die first before he is bound. Now, the next thing then, what would happen?
And they're taken out into the wilderness to be put to death by that...
Azazel, which means adversary in the Hebrew. Not today when you read it. They give a different application. But 1,500 years ago, 2,000 years ago, it had the actual adversary application. That term in the Talmud and are generally understood. Right now, the next thing, there's a place that tells about these two classes being dealt with first before something else happens. Two parts.
Oh, in Zechariah?
Has to be. Two parts would be cut off out of the land. And the third part would be brought through fire. Now, the two parts there has to do with the little flock and the great company class, that they have to have their change cut out of the land of the living, just as Jesus was cut out of the land of the living and didn't leave any seed behind, and Daniel tells us about him. He was violently taken out. It indicates that the others are the last members of the little flock, violently receive their change. The last members, even of the great company class, violently, they're cut out and have a violent change, but by different forces. One is an organized religious force in persecution where they share in honor, suffering like Christ suffered, where the great company class, they suffer violence, but they suffer it in the wilderness condition at the hands of the anarchist state, and it's a little different. Now, the third, the part that goes through the fire is
Israel
first, primarily, and their experience is shared by the world of mankind, but it's dealing particularly with Israel, so they are identified in that prophecy of Zechariah. It's the earthly class are now dealt with, and the fire there is the time of trouble, is the real severe trouble that takes place. It's the climax of this age. But that has to do with Israel. And in that chapter, it's not emphasizing about the other nations, but in other prophecies, it tells about the other nations. Now, when it comes to the real time of trouble at this end of the age, who gets it first? You can't go by the Zechariah, because that's only dealing with these three classes. Alright, the unrighteous, but in a general way. In other words, it will be the various nations, let's call them Gentiles. There's another prophecy that speaks of all the Gentiles. Darkness will come on them. Remember in Isaiah, it tells us. In Isaiah, it tells us near the end, the 60 chapter. Chapter 60. Now, there's one other before this. In Ezekiel, when we studied Ezekiel prophecy, you'll notice that when Gog and Magog go down into the Holy Land, it mentions that the people are at rest. They are in a relatively prosperous state, having gotten much cattle and goods and dwelling competently in the navel of the earth, in the midst of the land, dwelling competently. Now, while Israel at that time is dwelling competently, Gog and Magog go down there to take booty. They are not having peaceful conditions in their own countries, nor is the rest of the world. The rest of the world, darkness is settling down on them. And this chapter begins with that aspect, that while darkness is over, thick darkness over the other peoples, and this is not just this prophecy, there are two or three others that show that this gloom is all over all the nations, but in this mess, Israel, for a short time, is having apparently a measure of peace and prosperity, and they will even then deal with their enemies at that time from a military standpoint. But this is even before Jacob's trouble. So then we have trouble over the other nations and relative peace in Israel. Now this trouble over the other nations precedes that of Israel's last hour dilemma when Gog and Magog go. This other trouble will continue, therefore, these 3 years after the church is taken beyond the veil will be a general time of trouble all over the world. And you could call that, if you want to, the time of trouble in a general sense, in a broader sense, because what has happened, the churches have fallen down. And in this period of time, after the churches fall down, the state governments begin to fall all over the earth. They're visited with judgments. And in this period of time of darkness and all these nations and violence and so forth, and poverty and so forth, in that darkness of trouble for 3 years, all nations are experiencing that. But in the fore part of it, Israel isn't. It says, "For behold, darkness shall cover the earth." Notice it? It covers the earth, and gross darkness the people. But the Lord shall arise upon thee, and his glory shall be seen upon thee. Now what happens? They first go down to Israel because of its relative peaceful conditions and relative prosperity. It invites the plunder of some bands or hordes from the north, from Russia. But when they go down there, this is ephemeral. This period of rest of Israel really is just the before their storm. Because right after this invasion takes place, then all Israel gets dark. It says that this horde that comes down is like a cloud to cover the land. So their darkness, Israel's darkness, is at the end of this three-year period. Right at the very end, and this is the climax of this era after the church is gone beyond the veil, till Israel, Gog and Magog, go down there. This is towards the end of this period of time. That the darkness now begins to settle momentarily on Israel, and this is the time of Jacob's trouble, and it mentions it as a terrible, terrible experience. Yes?
But according to sequential order here, it doesn't sound as though Israel's having trouble.
No, no. What happens is that this is like in this experience where they have this favorable condition there, it invites plunder and booty. But it serves as a trap. But in their going down there, the Lord has purposed that just before his full glory rises upon them, in the sense when the hordes are destroyed. Because when the hordes are destroyed down there, then the Lord's glory will be seen to rise on Israel, as it were, in one day, when he destroys all that host. But before they come and they destroy that host, he lets them have a measure of prosperity in the midst of all this darkness. Israel has this measure. It's really inviting the people, setting them to come into this trap. But in this coming in, the Lord is not going to deliver Israel right away. He sees they needed a certain chastening lesson, just like the rest of the nations. Only at that time, that's their time of trouble. So Jacob's time of trouble in this real sense, like the world anarchy, is much later. The world is experiencing it, say, for 3 years, where Israel may only experience it for, say, for 6 months or less. I'm just using it as a rough estimate. And in this period of the 3 years, that third year, the church, the great public lives have to have their change. Just before. So this is coming, the great companies change, and the invasion of the Holy Land are about the same time. Because then another prophecy tells us that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion, they didn't realize that the Lord allowed them that measure of prosperity they did in that period of time in their power. And he says, don't you know that the saw that cuts the trees down, that I've been the one that's wielding that saw? Do you think you've been doing it all along? Then he punishes the fruit of that one who's puffed up with pride, the power that goes down in there, and they are dealt with. But at the same, but the two parts have to be when he hath performed his whole work, and the great company class is a part of that work. But the great company class can be on the scene, up to even into the invasion period of Israel. The great company class might be here when Israel is invaded, but not when they're punished, because that's when they have to be. After he has performed his whole work upon Mount Zion, that then he will punish this. Now, in the account of this experience of Jacob's trouble, we have for years suggested that the scripture means that the city of Jerusalem will actually be taken, and that there will be some people taken into exile, which means that'll be a period of time. So that when Gog and Magog goes down into Israel, they will be victorious momentarily. And not only just for a few days, but possibly for weeks. this will be Israel is defeated, prostrate, being plundered. And the rest, some have been taken into exile. Then, when everything is absolutely helpless from a visual and physical standpoint, that then the Lord steps in and delivers Israel after they have been chastened to such an extent that they almost are made a full end of. They're not quite made a full end of. In other words, they're just beginning mopping up operations. Then the Lord steps in and delivers his people. So that the great company class can be here a fairly long length of time. Yes?
You had mentioned in a previous study that the ancient worthy could be possibly resurrected beforehand and...
No, I didn't.
...and educated.
I never said that.
I mean, before they actually are recognized.
No, I haven't said that. I've never believed it. If it's on the tape, it's not my thought, because I have always used this scripture at all times of my life. At midnight, I shall arise. It's in that, in connection with the exercise of the punishment of Gog and Magog, that then the ancient worthies appear on the scene. In connection with this miraculous intervention, that at that moment, the ancient worthies appear on the scene. They are on the scene before the peaceful aspect of the kingdom, yes. They come up in the trouble. Not the trouble of Israel, because Israel is being defeated. Israel is falling, and the ancient worthies aren't there to witness that. But when the Lord's trouble, when the Lord is troubling the host that has invaded Israel, in connection with that trouble, the ancient worthies appear on the scene before the instructional aspect. And so then, as the trouble subsides, they are on hand right there. And the people are familiar with their identity at that moment. And later they see them in their true light. They don't see them, because in all this confusion, they don't. Everyone's thinking up for their own welfare. But as they sum things up, the fact that certain ones, that they don't die, we suggested one time. They may have compatriots who die, but they just seem to live a charmed life because they're written in the book that God has. There are certain Jews God will predetermine who are not going to die, and no matter what happens, death will take a holiday as far as they're concerned, and walls can fall and roofs can collapse. They're not going to die. And now when the ancient worthies are on hand at this moment, certain things will happen in connection with them. They will be identified with it in this wrath upon the enemies of Israel, that the ancient worthies will be on hand in that scene. Now, in just what capacity, I don't know. Then, when things subside and the people look about and see the corpses all around of the enemy, then the ancient worthies are there to explain it to them. What this is all about. The Lord will communicate through them right away. They're in the tomb. They don't have to be educated in the sense. They come out as perfect men now in physical stature. They've proven their faithfulness. The Lord instructs them. We can be instructed in one day if we're perfect. I'm just speaking from a human standpoint. The Lord said, you've been in the tomb, Abraham, for thousands of years. And this is the day that I've spoken of, just like restitution by all the prophets, so has this time of trouble been spoken of by all the prophets about Israel. There's a tremendous amount of it. So he gives them a rush course and tells them what to do, and the Lord's going to back them up. So these ancient worthies, nobody can do anything if they try to sass them. Remember Jeroboam tried to strike the prophet? What happened? His hand froze. Well, there'll be certain things with the ancient worthies in connection with their activities and their words that the Lord will be with them in such a way that they know that they are his representatives. Yeah.
I think there'll be those deliverances like they had back when they went out of Egypt. Or even while they were in Egypt, some of those plagues didn't fall on them. I was thinking, could it be like if Moses and Aaron would come forth? And being they were familiar with all these plagues back there, that possibly they might have a hand in it with the Lord in dealing with the people. And the
I tell you, if they ever came back with their own old clothing and all, and Moses with his rod, and Aaron with the breastplate, I mean, if they came back like that, you know, and were together, and it wouldn't take too long. The Lord could use certain other things, just like he used with Moses, gave him a supernatural light about his body, or face, rather, in his case. He had a supernatural glow about his face. Well, they knew that's an unusual person. So they see these personages that are ancient worthies, maybe their body will have a radiance, a glory. There'll be some way in which the people will recognize that while they are saved miraculously, these people are just a little bit more special than they themselves. And then the Lord will speak to them, just like he did audibly, with the ear. Like he spoke with Samuel. He actually gave Samuel instructions in his ear. And then Samuel then spoke.
So, yes. Frank, the argument is used that if the world would be in anarchy previous the Gog and Magog in Israel, that the armies couldn't be that organized to go down and take a spoil.
No, well, I've always said about the depots. You see, in the countries here, like we used to have right up in the Hudson River here, there were endless number of boats, about 15 miles from here, about 50, 60 boats filled with grain, almost to the sinking point, that's been there for years. That's only one depot. Throughout the United States of America, you have depots all over the country that are filled with food. Now, the employees that are associated with that know about it. Now, the thing is, while it's secret now, and there's no concern, because if you have a full stomach and you have your pay envelope, you're not concerned. You don't give a second thought to that food. But just let the food run out here. And nobody, no food in the supermarket. Then you begin looking around, and the least little person. Now, a few people will know about those boats, for instance, just to give an illustration. And they'll start to make an excursion up there. And then they'll come back with some food, and they'll say, well, where'd you get that? And then they'll tell their friends, and their friend's friend, and eventually they're all there, just like a horde of ants, going to all the supply centers, wherever they may be. And these munitions that they have, when they invade countries, the United States or any other country, they have mountains of supplies that lasts an army up to a year. That's usually the ideal situation, to have enough on hand for 1 year. See, and then then during that year they're planning whether it'll be necessary to send more supplies over for the succeeding year, just like you have a budget where all our state municipal and federal government, everything is done from year-to-year basis. Oh, pardon me.
That's all right. It's just a little reminder.
Yeah. Thank
Even
you.
The anarchy in the French Revolution was strong enough to overthrow the government.
Yeah.
So they were organized enough, even though it was lawless.
Yes, that's, and they had food, too. These few food supplies are all gone. It's late now.
Yeah.
I forgot. So we'll have to conclude this. We'll have another study at least on this subject. I just wanted to give, just before we go into these pictures, a little like a resume of a general outline, and then go to the scriptures. Now we'll omit the usual hymn and conclude this study tonight, or it's been more of a talk tonight, with a word of prayer.